Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. 2 hours of open forum today. I'm guessing, I don't know, no one's assured me, but I'm guessing some groovy music because it's Thursday. We got Jim. Oh, I just got a look on Darren's face like maybe no on the groovy music. Jimmy Akin here with us both hours. Open forum, 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Open forum just means open to everyone, open to everything. Ask what you'd like, whoever you are. 888-318-7884. Jimmy Akin, of course, proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, where tomorrow, I already know because Jimmy was with us yesterday, will be the second episode in the big two-part Loch Ness Monster series on Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World.
Yeah, and we'll be revealing why the Loch Ness Monster suddenly burst into consciousness into public consciousness in 1934. Because something very specific happened in that year that led to that.
The discovery of LSD?
Nope.
None of my guesses have paid off. Is it aliens or demons?
Which
is
neither.
All right. Not aliens, not demons. Well, we'll have to tune in tomorrow to find out. They drop early in the morning here in California. Wherever you are, they drop on Friday, 888.
I will say it has something to do with another famous monster.
Not Hitler.
Nope.
He was a monster, though. Mm-hmm. All right. I don't know. I just have to tune in tomorrow and find out. Let's see. How many? We got one line open right now, so you can still dial and get in, and we'll get you on with Jimmy if you got a question. A load of people already on, so I'm feeling like going straight to the phones. Is that okay with you, Jimmy?
Sure.
All right.
I'm here for.
Let's go to Colin in Toronto, Ontario, Canada, watching on YouTube. Colin, thanks for your call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi there. I have a question that sort of concerns the relationship between Jesus and Mary after Jesus was born. So I've heard of this concept called microchimerism, where it's essentially embryonic cells from the fetus goes into the mother and implant in her tissue and then multiply. So essentially there's an area of cells within the mother that is genetically the infant. And this can last like decades after a baby's been born. So I guess my question is, like, does that have any implications for Mary in terms of, is she somehow still carrying Jesus possibly, like even after Jesus was born and then like even after he ascends conceivably?
Well, she wouldn't be carrying Jesus because Jesus is a person, and the person Jesus left her womb at birth. And so she wasn't carrying the person Jesus after his birth. But given that we now have evidence that the cells of an unborn child can detach and implant in the mother and remain there for extended periods, it's quite possible that Mary continued to carry cells from Jesus for an extended period. And we don't know how long that lasts, but conceivably for the rest of her life. So conceivably, Mary could have cells from Jesus in her womb today.
Like in heaven, she could still have cells of Jesus.
Yeah. No, I can't prove that she does, but it's possible that she does.
Does that have any implications considering that Jesus is God? Like, does the cells that would have gone out of him, are they still God in the same way that he is God?
God is a person, and the person Jesus is God. But if you have like a fingernail clipping of Jesus or a hair of Jesus, it would be a holy relic, but it wouldn't be Jesus. It wouldn't be God. And so I would not look at little bits of Jesus's cells that detach from his body as retaining the hypostatic union with divinity.
Colin, thank you for starting us off with a very interesting question.
And I can even cite precedent for that in Catholic tradition, because there was for a while there was a belief in some parts of Christendom in what's known as the Holy Prepuce, which was basically Jesus's foreskin. And it was thought that that this had been preserved as a relic. Now, I don't know anyone today who thinks that that's accurate. But when there was widespread belief in the Holy Prepuce, it was regarded as a relic, but not as Jesus himself.
Again, Colin, thanks very much for the call. Lots of folks on the line. On we go with more questions for Jimmy Akin. It's open forum today on Catholic Answers Live. Edmund in California listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Thanks for downloading the app onto your phone. Edmund, go ahead with your question for Jimmy. Nope, I didn't do it. He disappeared, but I know that was not me. How about we go back to Canada? Ava in Ontario, Canada, watching on YouTube. Ava, we're glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. And thanks for the books that you sent me about apologetics, because they've been very helpful and I've been able to write a paper.
Hey, great, Ava. What year are you in school?
I would be in grade 10. I'm homeschooled.
All right. Well, I'm glad they were helpful to you, Ava. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Thank you. I was talking with a Protestant, and he brought up the rapture, and I said we don't believe in the rapture because it's unbiblical, and he said that the verse where it says one shall be taken and one shall be left proves the rapture, but from what I understand, that's not the rapture, and the person that's taken is actually the one that is destroyed. Is that true?
Okay, so I would approach the subject a little differently in talking with a Protestant friend. Rather than simply saying we don't believe it because it's unbiblical, I would try to find common ground. And that's something I do in general as part of apologetics. Whenever I'm talking with someone who's coming from a different faith perspective, I try to find common ground, things that we agree on. And that has a couple of good effects. One of the things that it does is it shows that you're being nice. You know, you're not just trying to be contradictory or contrary. You're not being just, confrontational. You're looking for things we can agree on. And that demonstration of goodwill will make it more likely that the person will give you a sympathetic hearing. That if they see you're a person of goodwill and you're trying to find things that we agree on, That'll make them friendlier to you. It shows you're being friendly to them. It'll make them friendlier to you. The other good thing that it does is it clarifies, if you do identify common ground, is it clarifies exactly where our disagreements are. So it identifies things that we don't need to fight about. In the case of the rapture, Catholics don't use the term rapture historically. It's a term that was developed in a Protestant context in the 19th century. So it's actually quite a recent Protestant term, and it's only found in some areas in Protestantism. It's not part of historic Protestantism. But even though Catholics have not historically used the term rapture, we do acknowledge that there's an event where believers will be caught up to be with Jesus, because St. Paul says that in 1 Thessalonians 4:17. So and that's the main passage that Protestant supporters of the rapture idea will appeal to, because St. Paul says it flat out that when Jesus comes back, we're going to get caught up to be with him and we'll always be with the Lord. The question is, when does this event occur? Because we agree there is going to be an event like this. And what happens next? And if you read 1 Thessalonians carefully, and if you especially read it in light of what Paul also says about the second coming of Jesus in 2 Thessalonians, it's clear that this event will occur at the second coming, not sometime prior to a millennium that itself precedes the end of the world by more than 1,000 years. So the way I would tend to approach it in speaking with a Protestant friend would be to say, well, we don't tend to use that term. It's not our term, but we do acknowledge that there's going to be this event. But if you look at the text carefully, it indicates this is something that happens at the end of the world, not over a millennium before the end of the world. Now, in terms of the specific passage that he cited about one will be taken, another left, that's from the Olivet Discourse. The Olivet Discourse is Jesus's major prophetic discourse. It's a speech that he gave, or a sermon that he gave, on the Mount of Olives. That's why it's called the Olivet Discourse. And it's found in three of the Gospels. The earliest version of it is in Mark 13. It's also in Luke 21, and it's in Matthew 24 and 25. And when you look in Mark and Luke, the occasion for the Olivet Discourse is they've just come out of the temple and crossed the Kidron Valley to the Mount of Olives. And as they're doing that, the disciples are commenting on the big, impressive stones that the temple is made out of and how beautiful it is. And Jesus says, well, I got to tell you guys, see all those stones? They're all going to be thrown down. There's not going to be one left on another. The temple's going to be destroyed. And so when they get to the Mount of Olives, the core disciples come to Jesus and they say, you know, we kind of need closure on that. Can you tell us more about when the temple is going to be destroyed? And that's the question they're asking. They're not asking about the end of the world. They're asking about the destruction of the temple. And so we should understand the Olivet Discourse as not telling us about the end of the world, at least not directly, but instead telling us about the period between Jesus's day and when the temple was destroyed in AD 70. So this is already fulfilled prophecy. Now, when we go to Matthew, it's a little bit different. In Matthew, like in Mark and Luke, the scene is the same. They've just come out of the temple. Jesus has predicted it's going to be destroyed, and the disciples ask, "Tell us more. What's the sign that this is going to happen? That the temple is going to be destroyed?" But then they also ask an additional question, and it's significant that in Matthew's version alone, there's some additional material in the Olivet Discourse. After the material that repeats what's in Mark and Luke, there are these parables at the end, like the wise and the foolish virgins and the parable of the sheep and the goats. So you have these additional parables that do apply to the end of the world. And so it looks like that's the area of Matthew's version of the Olivet Discourse that does deal with the end of the world. But that's not where one will be found in the earlier section of the Olivet Discourse, which deals with the destruction of the temple. And if you look at what Jesus is saying, he's making a comparison to the time of the flood. He noted that in the days of the flood, people were going about their business, and then the flood came and took them all away and destroyed that civilization. And Jesus is saying in the same way, leading up to the destruction of the temple, people will be going about their business, and then it will be like it was at the flood. There will be this sudden thing that happens and takes people away, and one will be taken and another will be left. Well, in context, the way to understand that would be, at least the straightforward understanding, would be that it's going to be the destruction of the war that leads to the temple being destroyed. That destruction is going to take some people away. They're going to get killed in the war. Other people will be left. They'll survive the war. And so in read in context, what this statement seems to be about is the destruction that people will experience leading up to the destruction of the temple. It's not about the end of the world. It's about events that have already taken place for our perspectives. And that's why Jesus says, when you see these things happening, let those who are in Judea flee, because Judea is where the war is going to take place. It's not something that's affecting the whole world. It's something that's affecting Judea. So does that help, Ava?
Hang on, Ava. I put you on hold for a quick second. Go ahead. Does that help you?
Yes, thank you. I'll be able to tell him that about the rapture. And it's a good idea about finding common ground, because that's what he always says to me whenever I about purgatory confession, he says, I don't believe that because it's not in the Bible. So I'll have to do that. Thank you.
Sounds good.
Ava,
good job.
You sound like a very sharp person. Thank you very much. I hope you will call again. We got to take our break. We'll take that break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
We're here for you. Call now. Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
The most original and exclusive Catholic content is on EWTN Radio.
I'm a Dominican, and St. Dominic was an itinerant preacher who went around and touched people's lives by open-air preaching. The radio opens the possibilities of doing this to the entire world in a very intimate sense.
EWTN Open Line Thursday with Father Brian Mulady. Tonight, 10 Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. Jimmy Akin's our guest. Jimmy's got a new podcast starting on January 1st. It's going to be his book, A Daily Defense. It's the Daily Defense podcast. So for about 3 minutes each day, you learn new apologetics arguments. And if you subscribe to the Daily Defense podcast at the beginning, you'll be notified each day and we'll guarantee you the best minutes you spend that day learning apologetics. Check it out over at catholic.com. Let's see. Nate in Dallas is next. Nate, watching on YouTube. Or I should say, our old friend, Nate. Hi, Nate.
Oh, that's so sweet. Happy holidays. I'm just kidding. Merry Christmas.
No, I don't take any offense when people wish me happy holidays. I think that's a very nice thing, but Merry Christmas, Nate.
I just wanted to tease a little bit. I wanted to talk about double effect. In my opinion, it seems contrary to scripture. And the reason is, well, first, double effect, is, if I'm understanding correctly, comes from Thomas Aquinas from the Summa, second part of the second part, question 64. And it addresses whether or not it's okay to kill somebody in self-defense. So it seems to me that that's kind of subjective. It seems to me that his answer is saying that it's okay to do it in some cases if it calls for it, the situation calls for it. And that feels to me like an ends justify the means argument, which I thought is counter to Catholic teaching. It kind of also feels like fruit of the poisonous tree. So Aquinas kind of touches on this when he says, quote, an act may be rendered unlawful if it be out of proportion to the end. So this argument about double effect seems to hinge entirely on subjective reasoning or subjective morality. Like, if you think it's worth it, if you think that the ends justify those means. But also, it seems like Jesus taught completely contrary to this in Matthew 16, talks about whoever wants to save their life will lose it. In Matthew 5, he talks about if someone, you've heard it said, eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. I say, resist, do not resist evil. If someone strikes you, turn the other cheek. Love your neighbor. Love your enemies. Do good to them that hate you. So does it seem kind of moot to me that Aquinas would say it's okay sometimes to fight back to the point of Jesus says, no, never do that, never resist evil? And also, doesn't it seem like fruit of the poisonous tree or subjective morality? Thanks, Jimmy.
Okay, so there are quite a number of things there to respond to. Let's start, and I'll and you can tell me if I miss any of them. The first thing is fruit of the poisonous tree is a phrase that I'm not used to encountering in this context. You may be aware of a usage that I'm not familiar with, but the usage of that phrase that I'm familiar with involves legal doctrine, where if evidence is gathered in an improper way, then any evidence you discover as a result of that initial improper action is also to be excluded and not to be considered as evidence by the court. For example, if let's suppose I'm a police officer and without probable cause, I violate someone's civil rights and do an illegal search of their property, and I discover a bunch of evidence that they may have committed a crime. Well, that evidence, because it was an illegal search, has to be excluded. But if after I found the evidence with my, that they had committed a crime with my illegal search, I then went on and now had probable cause and did more searches and found even more evidence, then that evidence that I found as a result of the initial illegal search would also have to be excluded. That's the so-called fruit of this poisonous tree that I planted by doing the initial illegal search. So that's what I'm familiar with as the meaning of that idiom. I'm not familiar with it being used in this context. The law of double effect, now you said it came from St. Thomas Aquinas, and he certainly discusses it, but I don't know that he's the author of it. In fact, I'd be rather surprised if he was, because the principles had been things that people were thinking about for, you know, 1,200 years before his time at least. And so I would be surprised if he was the person who originated this concept. It does not involve, well, let me put it this way. There's always a subjective element involved in weighing moral values. And so you're correct that because one of the conditions for the law of double effect is that the evil that you're tolerating has to be outweighed by some good, there is a weighing process that goes on. And that is inescapably subjective, since we good and evil are non-empirical values. We can't measure them with scientific instruments. And so we have to, as part of moral reasoning, make a subjective appraisal of the different weights of different things. However, that's not contrary to Jesus' own thought. Jesus himself in Matthew 23 talks about how the scribes and Pharisees would tithe even little bitty bits of their herb gardens. You know, if they were growing mint as an herb, they would, and mint is very prominent, as you may know, Sykelet, in Middle Eastern cookery. But if they were growing mint in their herb garden, they would even take a tenth of the mint and give that to the priests as a tithe. And Jesus says, good for you for doing that, but you need to pay attention to more weighty matters of the law, like justice and mercy. So Jesus himself recognizes that there is a difference in weight between different moral matters. Justice and mercy are more important than tithing a tenth of your mint. And he expects people, including the scribes and Pharisees, to make that appraisal, even though it's a subjective appraisal. So Jesus does not have a problem with making subjective appraisals of moral situations and then acting on the basis of those appraisals. When it comes to, so you're right, there is this subjective element involved, but number one, Jesus doesn't have a problem with that. Number two, just because there's a subjective element involved doesn't mean that that it's all subjective. One of the things about the law of double effect is it does care about the means that are being used in a particular situation. I cannot, for example, deliberately take an innocent life. I can tolerate an innocent person ending up dying as a result of some action that's otherwise very important, you know, because if for no other reason, life involves risk. And sometimes, you know, innocent people will die as a result of that risk, and that can be tolerated. But what I can't do is deliberately kill an innocent person. And so the means, whether you're merely allowing something or whether you're deliberately doing it, is important in the law of double effect. And so it's the law of double effect is not simply a consequentialist do anything if it's weighty enough. There are limits to what the law of double effect will allow you to do. It will not allow you to use improper means like killing the innocent to achieve some end. Then we come to the question of to the exegetical question that you brought up about, well, Jesus says don't press your rights and, you know, go the other mile and, you know, turn the other cheek and things like that. And those are all true. Jesus did say those things, but we cannot read out of those a total endorsement of pacifism. One of the things that you have to do with Jesus is take the whole of his teachings in context. And there's the music, so I'll tell you more about that on the other side of the break.
Hang on, Nate. We'll be right back. It's Open Forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest. 888-31-TRUTH is the number. Here's a question. Is it really possible to be friends with someone who died 2,000 years ago? Maybe the problem is that we've grown way too comfortable with the story of Jesus. Nice man, right? Taught us to love one another, said not to judge people. We celebrate his birthday every year. It's time to put away this small, safe version of Jesus, says Cy Kellett. Nobody that bland could have transformed the world. In A Teacher of Strange Things, Cy presents Jesus Christ undiluted by sentiment, with all his radical words and deeds uncensored. Do you know someone, your son or daughter perhaps, or maybe your mom or dad, who needs the friendship of Jesus Christ? Do you? Order your copy of A Teacher of Strange Things by visiting shop.catholic.com today or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you. Have you enrolled in the Catholic Answers School of Apologetics? Let me ask you a more important question. Do you believe as a Catholic that you have an obligation to share the Catholic faith? In fact, the Church has answered this question, and the answer is that all confirmed Catholics are obliged to share the faith. It's actually in canon law. Catholic Answers is here to help you fulfill that obligation. Our School of Apologetics courses will equip you to help all the people you come in contact with understand what the Church teaches and why. A great place to start is with all the Catholics in your life. Learn the art of apologetics from the best of the best and start sharing the gospel today. Visit schoolofapologetics.com. That's schoolofapologetics.com.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
This is Dr. David Anders. Are your friends or family discouraging you from becoming Catholic?
We can help on Call to Communion tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern.
Now, back to Catholic Answers Live.
Groovy music for you. Thank you, Darren. It's Thursday. Jimmy Akin's here. It's Open Forum. There's some groovy music. We're having a good time here. Nate's on the line from Dallas, Texas, asking essentially whether the idea of double effect is similar to the ends justify the means. Jimmy, you were explaining that it is not.
Yeah, because as I mentioned, in the law of double effect, not any means is justified. The means itself has to be licit, and you cannot use an illicit means in order to accomplish an end. So it's fundamentally different. However, the specific point I was addressing was the teachings of Jesus, because Nate brought up some passages where Jesus says things like turn the other cheek and don't resist, you know, someone and so forth. The point I was making is you have to read Jesus's teachings and understand them in their context as a whole. You don't want to just isolate individual teachings and absolutize them as if they were all you needed to consider. And this is a good example of that, because the place that these teachings are found, the ones that Nate cited, is the Sermon on the Mount. And that's Jesus's major ethical discourse. It's found in Matthew's chapter 5-7. And even within the Sermon on the Mount, we can show how Jesus's teachings make individual points that are meant to be understood in harmony with other individual points that he makes. For example, if you look towards the beginning of the Sermon on the Mount, this is in Matthew 5, Jesus at one point says, "Do your good works and let people see them so they can glorify your Father in heaven." Right? Psychella?
Yes.
He says that, right?
Yeah. Yes.
But then he turns around in Matthew 6, and he's saying, do your acts of righteousness in private so that you're not doing them to get glory from men, and your Father who sees what's done in secret will reward you. Okay, so those two things, if you took either one of those in isolation and absolutized it, you would get an erroneous conclusion. Jesus means us to understand these in harmony with each other. So to the extent that you can do your good works in a way that brings glory to God, do so. So God gets the glory. But if you're going to be tempted to get the glory for yourself, keep it private. And so we're not meant to take either one of these teachings in isolation. And we can see that right here in the Sermon on the Mount. So what about these teachings regarding resisting other people and violence? Well, essentially, what Jesus is saying is that, you know, we shouldn't press our rights. You know, we shouldn't always insist on having our way on everything. We should be generous people. We should be loving people, and we should be willing to tolerate it. When people do things to us that they shouldn't, but that doesn't mean that there are no limits to this. Being a nice person and not insisting on your rights does not mean being a doormat and letting someone do whatever they want to you and never resisting. Because in Luke's gospel, during the Last Supper, Jesus says, "You know, guys, how I sent y'all out and I told you not to take any provisions with you? You were going to live on the generosity of others like Blanche DuBois. Well, now the situation has changed. Now bring the stuff with you because it's going to get harder. You're not going to be able to depend on the kindness of strangers. Bring your stuff with you. And if you don't have a sword, go buy one." Now, as I'm sure you know, Psychellet, you don't spank people with swords. Swords are for killing people. This is the ancient equivalent, sociologically speaking, of a gun.
Yeah.
So the equivalent in our culture would be Jesus saying, if you don't have a handgun, go buy one. So Jesus obviously did not have a problem with the disciples using lethal force in self-defense. That's exactly why he told them to buy a sword. And we similarly don't find a pacifist ethic elsewhere. Now, it can't in the Bible, either Old Testament or New Testament. Now, it can be heroic to not insist on your rights, even to the point of martyrdom, but that's heroism. You are allowed to defend yourself and to take the life of an aggressor, especially if someone else is involved. If you're the father of a family and someone's menacing your kids, well, you might choose to allow yourself to be martyred, but you've got a responsibility to protect those kids. So Jesus himself acknowledges that it is legitimate to use lethal force in self-defense, and he and St. Thomas Aquinas would be fundamentally agreed.
Nate, thanks very much for that question. We do appreciate it, and we always like to hear from you. I got to turn now, however, into the studio for a question. Somebody on
that sounds metaphysically impossible.
To turn into the studio? Oh, well, I guess I'm not going to turn into the studio.
That'd be terrifying.
Okay. I'm going to turn inward into the... Hi, Thomas.
Hi, Si. That's less terrifying.
Yeah. Somebody saw you on...
Dude. Whoa, that jacket.
I wonder what Jimmy was reacting to. Yeah, Thomas is wearing the cheerful Christmas jacket that makes the rounds around here at Catholic Answers. And you do look really... I think spiffy is probably the right word. Yeah, you do look Christmassy.
Spiffy, Christmassy. I love this jacket, Si.
Someone on YouTube saw you coming into the studio and said, "Here comes the Chinese spyware." Why would they say that?
Maybe because I'm bringing a question from TikTok.
Oh, that's probably it. Yes. It's time for Thomas the TikTok Engine, which is we've settled on that, right? That's the name now?
I think that could
Thomas
be it.
Thomas the TikTok Engine.
I think that could be
ahead,
it.
Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Patent pending. All right, Jimmy. So the question I brought to you today from TikTok, which people can find our TikTok page at Catholic Answers. It's very simple. If they want to test the waters of the Chinese spyware, is can you please answer if Catholics should believe in Santa and tell their children about Santa?
Well, it depends on what you mean. There was a real historical Saint Nicholas. He was a bishop from Turkey. He lived in the AD 300s, and he is reported to have participated in the very first ecumenical council that declared that Jesus Christ is God. So he was a real guy, and we should believe in him as a historical figure. Now, if you mean the fantasy version of Saint Nicholas, the one that comes down chimneys and delivers presents to children in the dead of night on the bridge between December 24th and December 25th, with eight tiny reindeer and lives at the North Pole or in Japan, lives on the moon, then, we shouldn't believe in that because that's a fantasy version of Saint Nicholas. In terms of what should we teach our children about Saint Nicholas, well, we can certainly teach them about the historical Saint Nicholas. We can also play fun pretend games with them about the fantasy Saint Nicholas, you know, just like we watch movies with them and read stories to them, and they know that's pretend. And so if you want to play, you know, let's pretend that Santa Claus is going to bring you these presents and stuff, well, then that certainly would be fine. What there's more of a question about is, can you lie to your children and tell them that the fantasy version of Santa Claus is real and let them eventually slowly realize that he's not? Well, that's going to depend on your theory of lying. Personally, I would have a hard time justifying lying to my children about the fantasy version of Saint Nicholas, but the church has not made a definitive ruling on that question.
I just wish I'd had the forethought to say, hey, parents, you might want to turn off your radios for this one and come back.
I guess I wish you had as well, Thomas.
My apologies to the households whose Christmases I ruined.
I'm sure nobody's Christmas is ruined.
Just give him one of these jackets and they'll be a lot better.
The TikTok engine.
The Thomas who stole Christmas.
I know. I've become... You either die a hero or live long enough to see yourself become the villain. Is that the line?
I don't know, but it's right. I don't know if that's the line. I like your Catholic Answers hat. What happened to your Catholic Man Show hat? Did you...
I just cycle through.
Oh, you cycle through different hats. But you do wear a hat every day.
That's right.
Never see Thomas without a hat. Thanks, Thomas the TikTok Engine.
Thanks for having me, Si.
Look forward to doing this again sometime. Let me see who's next. Thomas looks stricken. Derek in Pennsylvania. Oh, no, we're going to Bill in Texas, listening on the EWTN app. Bill, we're glad you're here. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
My question is, when a person has extreme spiritual gifts, who do they go to? Is there a person or a website that can help? Because I've run into a lot of people who have, can see and hear angels and talk to angels or all sorts of different types of gifts, and they are kind of lost, you know. I have gone through that myself, but I've been dealing with this for like 40 years, so I've already gone through the whole gamut, but I'm calling more for other people that are out there that experience things.
Well, so the conventional way of handling reports of unusual experiences in a parish would be to have the pastor as the first person you'd talk to, and if a judgment needs to be made about, you know, are these experiences genuinely supernatural or not, that would be something that would fall to the bishop to investigate. The bishop also could be consulted in terms of figuring out, you know, what should a person do with the experiences they're having. There also are another kind of person that could be brought in would be a spiritual director, especially someone who has experience with what's called mystical theology. There are spiritual direction services, and like there's Dan Burke, for example, has a spiritual direction website that might contain some valuable resources. Also, you know, there are people with other forms of expertise. I'm qualified, I'm certified as a paranormal field investigator. So it's up my alley, and I, you know, occasionally assist people with situations that they're in and, you know, help them evaluate what's going on with various unusual experiences that they have. There's not a central ministry or anything, but those are the kinds of people that you would want to talk to in figuring out a situation where a person is having unusual experiences. The pastor, the bishop, a spiritual director, or someone who has expertise in such matters.
And I will say thank you very much for that question as well, because we got to take a break now. We'll take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.
Hello, this is Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione of San Francisco. Keep your dial tuned to Catholic Answers Live.
You've heard that St. Paul Street Evangelization supports hundreds of teams of evangelists sharing the good news. But did you know that some of these teams are public prayer stations? Set up a sign on the sidewalk and offer prayer and encouragement to those you encounter. Everyone needs prayer. Try this new method of witnessing to Jesus. Contact St. Paul Street Evangelization to get started at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
EWTN, communicating the faith.
So this is the first time I just put you guys on, and I'm calling in, and it is such a blessing to speak to you. And I want to say to all of your listeners that I'm thinking of you and praying for you. If you are out there and you are lonely, or you are sad, or you don't feel you have much to praise God about, I am praying for you that you will discover something and the Lord will really touch your heart today.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin is our guest, and Christmas approaches, so I wish you a very blessed, ongoing, continuing season of Advent leading up to the big day, Christmas Day. We got a whole new set of programs next week, so we'll be with you all next week after Christmas, so join us then if you like, if you've got the time. We sure appreciate that you spend the time with us. Up next, we go to Windsor, Connecticut. Anne Marie, listening on the EWTN app. Anne Marie, thanks for calling. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, thank you. I have a follow-up question on an earlier call about microchimerism.
Microchimerism,
Is it possible that science and faith meet in the dogma of the Assumption of Mary? And I say that because having the cells of baby Jesus, who is fully human and fully God within her, how could Mary not have been assumed body and soul into the glory of heaven?
Okay, so, she wasn't assumed the minute Jesus was. So, Jesus ascended into heaven 40 days after the resurrection, and we know Mary was not assumed at that point because she's still present later on, and consequently, that would demonstrate that Mary, the mere fact that Mary may have cells from the baby Jesus in her, or from the unborn baby Jesus in her womb, does not mean that she has to be in the same location as him. So otherwise she would have had to have been assumed at the same moment that he was, and she would never have been able to remain on earth. And since she did remain on earth, that indicates she can be in a different place than him. So there might be a certain fittingness to the fact that, yes, she has cells from Jesus in her womb, and that makes it appropriate for her to be assumed to be with Jesus, just like the fact that all Christians are spiritually united with Jesus, and as 1 Thessalonians 4 says, we will all eventually be caught up to be with him and will remain with him. There's a certain fittingness to that, but it's not something that has to be, because we can see that it actually didn't happen immediately. But if you want to say it's fitting, then that's something you could certainly say.
Okay, thank you.
All right, Anne-Marie. Thank you. Thanks very much. The number's 888-31-TRUTH. It's open forum. Jimmy Akin is our guest. We come back out here to California now in Salinas, California. Christopher, watching on YouTube. Go ahead, Christopher, with your question.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Oh, we're very well. We're very well, Christopher. Sorry.
Good.
Go ahead.
That's okay. So my question is, what can be a way to respond to someone who has an anti-perspective to the Blessed Virgin Mary? I know on Monday it was the Feast of Our Lady of Guadalupe. Mm-hmm. And I did see in news reports that the Basilica received more than 8 million pilgrims after 3 years due to COVID restrictions. In social media, I saw, you know, a video of someone Protestant who was recording the pilgrims, and he was just being all very anti. He was just saying, there goes these, you know, pilgrims going to that big basilica, worshiping the Lady of Guadalupe, and he just was being very anti-Catholic, and he was quoting John 14:6, and he was saying, may God have mercy on these pilgrims. And I was kind of like laughing what he was saying, and in the end he's like, I'm not trying to offend no one, but, you know, I hope God has mercy on all those pilgrims, but I know as Catholic, you know, we don't worship the Virgin, we worship God, we just respect her, because I know there's the Greek word latria.
Christopher, you want to know how to respond to that kind of accusation of worshiping Mary?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I think you have the fundamental concept already. You've indicated we just don't worship Mary. And that's what one should do if someone is accusing us of worshiping Mary or worshiping anybody other than God. Say, actually, you know, no, we don't. And then it's just a question of how much detail do you need to go into about that with someone. Now, the Basilica of Guadalupe is in Mexico, an encounter on this subject. I think you mentioned the gentleman who was making the video was Protestant and a Spanish speaker. And I know some Spanish, but I don't know the details of the vocabulary in Spanish about how the equivalent terms for worship and honor work and exactly where they are similar and different and how much overlap they have. But in English, the term worship originally just meant showing honor to someone. That's why there are some British officials, you know, government officials who are known as Your Worship. Just like here in America, we call a judge Your Honor. And in Britain, there are certain officials, you call them Your Worship. And that's why Han Solo in Star Wars refers to Princess Leia as Your Worship. So this is just an old-fashioned usage. The word worship, its roots in English, comes from worth ship. So a ship in this context means the state of something, and worth is the state of being worthy. So if someone's worthy, you give them worship. Well, that's not how the term has evolved in English. It's evolved to refer to not just giving someone honor in general, but specifically the kind of honor that is due to God alone. And so in colloquial American English, if you're going to talk about worship, it is something that you need to reserve to God alone. And we simply don't give that to Mary. We give Mary another form of honor, but we don't give her that. Now, the church in Latin developed some terminology to help us with these distinctions. These terms originally did not have technical meanings, but they came to have technical meanings so that Christians could express themselves more precisely. And the word for the kind of honor you'd give an ordinary saint is known as dulia. The kind of honor you'd give Mary, because she's a special saint, is hyperdulia, which means above regular dulia. And the kind of worship you'd give God is known as latria. Well, those are terms that the church has authorized people to use in Latin to express these distinctions. And so that illustrates that the church herself recognizes there are distinctions in the kind of reverence or honor that we give to God versus the kind that we give to Mary or other people. It's certainly the case that we are meant to give honor to other people. I mean, the New Testament even says, give honor to whom honor is due. So, you know, and that includes your parents. Honor your father and mother. It includes church leaders. It includes holy people. And Mary is a holy person. So we are going to owe honor to Jesus's mother. In fact, in Luke chapter 1, Mary herself says, behold, all generations will call me blessed, because she gets to be the mother of the Messiah. So that of itself recognizes, and she's speaking under divine inspiration at that point. So the Holy Spirit recognizes there is a role for all generations of Christians honoring Mary. Now, if someone wants to say, well, I think you're actually giving them the worship that God alone is due, say, okay, tell me why. How do you know? Are you telepathic? You know, can you read my mind and tell that I think about Mary exactly the same way I think about God? Because if that's what you think, you need to go practice your telepathy some more, because that's not what I believe. I believe God is the infinite creator of the universe, and I believe Mary is a finite creature. So I don't believe the same thing about God and Mary. I think God is infinitely above Mary in the order of things. And so consequently, I don't give Mary the same kind of honor. I fundamentally think about her as a human being, not as a deity. And so those are some of the things that I would point out to someone who made these kind of charges, making the appropriate adjustments for whatever language the discussion is occurring in.
Does that all make good sense to you, Christopher?
Yes, but the only thing where he was, the person in the video was indicating that he was thinking that the Blessed Virgin Mary saves, but, you know, I know that the church teaches that that's not true, the one who saves is our Lord, and that's the one thing that I would agree with the person in the video.
Yeah, and that's good. As I mentioned to a previous caller, you know, find common ground. The more you identify common ground with someone, the more reasonable you show that you are to that person, and the fewer things you have to fight about. So, you know, if you're talking to someone and they're saying only Jesus saves, you can say, I agree, amen. You know, so definitely finding common ground is a good strategy.
Christopher, thanks very, very much. I'll tell you what, Christopher, I enjoyed this conversation. If you'd like to hang on, if you want a copy of Jimmy's book, The Words of Eternal Life, True Happiness and Where to Find It, I haven't given out that book at all today. So I'd love to send you a copy, and it's easy for us to get it to you in Salinas, California. As I mentioned earlier, Jimmy Akin has a new podcast coming January 1st, and we've got a bunch of new podcasts around here. It's podcast season around here. So the Daily Defense podcast starts on January 1st. And that goes through the year, little explanations of apologetic arguments each day. But Joe Heschmeyer's got a new podcast out now, already out, Shameless Popery. New episodes drop every Thursday for Shameless Popery, and you can find that by going to shamelessjoe.com, shamelessjoe.com, because there are a lot of people like me who can't figure out how to spell popery. And so shamelessjoe.com. Carlo's new podcast is out, The Sunday Catholic Word. There's new episodes every Friday. And on The Sunday Catholic Word, Carlo will kind of read, well, he won't kind of, he'll share with you the readings for that Sunday, but mine them, dig into them for the apologetic value that they have for Catholic apologetics. Just go to sundaycatholicword.com for that one. sundaycatholicword.com. Don't forget Council of Trent. Still out there. Trent Horn still doing the Council of Trent. We're still doing Catholic Answers Focus. You can put those in there and find them. And of course, Jimmy's main podcast, is one of the most popular documentary podcasts in America. It's Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Drops every Friday. New episode will drop tomorrow, but there's hundreds of episodes for you to enjoy. Go to mysterious.fm or just put in the words Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World in your machine and it will find it. You will find it. Lots more questions to come. It's Open Forum with Jimmy Akin next hour on Catholic Answers Live.